Okay, that's going. I sent him the PowerPoint, but he's probably asleep right now. It's like 5 a.m. his time, so you'll just have to, but there's nothing that you need to have it locally for. Okay, welcome everyone. This is week 8 of Principles of Economics, the winter 2011 session. And we are talking today about tariffs and quotas. So a very important part of an introductory economics lesson. It's possibly it's arguably the single most important topic that the average person should know in terms of free market principles, just because it comes up a lot, and it's here where I think it's hardest for the average person to understand the economic analysis. So in other words, people's intuitions and their prejudices just naturally lead them to reject the case for free trade. They just instinctively seem to think that it helps our country if we keep out goods made by those foreigners. You know, we want to protect our jobs here. So that's so it's in this area where I think taking economics is most useful, or studying economics is most useful at the introductory level. And it's, like I say, it's really hard to beat back this case for mercantilism. Right? So mercantilism historically was a doctrine that basically said that the way a nation grew rich was to accumulate money. All right? And it's sort of had a, it was more plausible back when it was actually, you know, officially in vogue, because back then the money was typically the precious metals like gold or silver, and so it sort of stood to reason that if you're a particular kingdom, let's say if you're running France and you're advising the French king, and he says, how do we make ourselves prosper, and especially if he's vying for you know, against the other kings in Europe, there was sort of a plausibility to it, to say, oh, well, what you want to do is you want to accumulate more gold than the other kingdoms. And so then how do you do that? Well, if we're using gold as the basis of our international trade exchange, well, then we want to accumulate, for us to accumulate more gold means other nations have to decumulate gold or silver, whatever, you know, whatever people are actually using. And so how would you do that besides just stealing their gold? Well, you would want to sell more stuff to them because they have to pay you in gold than you buy from them, because then you'd have to pay them in gold. And so if you're doing that over time, if you're consistently, if your kingdom, if the people in your kingdom are selling more stuff abroad than they're buying from foreigners, well, then that means on net, there's an influx of the precious metals into your country. Okay, so that was what mercantilism was, and it was, so that was the philosophy, and then it was a whole economic program of discouraging imports, right? Because you don't, because anytime your people buy something made by foreigners, that's money leaving the country, which you don't want as the king. And if you're a mercantilist. And so you would come up with ways to discourage your own people from buying from foreigners, and then also come up with ways to encourage your producers to sell things to foreigners. All right, so obviously you see the relevance. It's not just some ancient doctrine that's been long forgotten that is with us today. And like I said, it actually, I mean, it was still wrong back then, but it was more plausible when the money was actual hard money, like, you know, gold and silver, as opposed to now when the money is all fiat paper. So the historically what happened, this is the great contribution of the classical economists. All right, so Adam Smith in particular, and then the French economists were the ones who really made the case for free trade eloquent. But Adam Smith, in his book, The the Wealth of Nations, and I mean the longer title is the General Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations or something like that, right? So what he's doing in that book and why it's correct to say that one of the things he does there is blow up the case for mercantilism is because he's saying, what is it that makes a country wealthy? And he's saying it doesn't a nation's wealth doesn't really consist in how much money it has, right? Because money per se is not productive. It's not. It doesn't make you rich, right? That it's true. Any individual person, if he has more money and everything else is equal, then that person's wealthier. But the point is, if the whole nation just has more gold, that doesn't make us wealthier. Except insofar as you might use the gold to buy something from abroad, right? So just, it's kind of a subtle point, but just think through that for a minute. Let's say you're the French king and your ministers are all mercantilists and they're advising you saying, you know, sire, we know that the way to become prosperous and wealthy is to accumulate gold and silver coin. And so let's make sure that we conduct our policy vis-a-vis other nations so that we're always selling more to them than they are to us and that we can accumulate more and more gold and silver. But if you asked, why are we doing that? And they say, oh, because we're wealthier. You say, so if a nation, you know, is going to attack us because we have gold and silver coins, you know, we're going to use them as shields or we're going to throw them really fast and it's going to kill the invading soldiers because the gold and silver is going to hit them in the head. And they say, well, no, I mean, we're going to buy stuff with it. And you say, okay, but we're going to buy stuff that we ourselves make, and we need to have gold and silver from abroad in order to buy stuff from our own countrymen. And you say, well, no, what we need the gold and silver for is to buy stuff from abroad. Okay, and so you see that it's sort of a contradiction there, that they're saying we don't want to buy stuff from abroad so that we have the ability to buy stuff from abroad. If, you know, I mean, they don't actually come out and say that because they don't analyze it that far through. But that's the point, okay? That if you were accumulating gold and silver that you were only going to spend domestically, well, that would just raise prices domestically. Okay, so something, you know, if I'm just making up numbers here, but if the kingdom, your kingdom of France originally had 1,000 units of gold and the prices were a certain level, and then because of your policies now they have 2,000 units, right? So they've doubled the gold stock. Well, other things equal, that would just raise the price of everything in France by a factor of 2, quoted in terms of gold, all right? And so your people wouldn't be richer in that respect, all right? So the only benefit your entire kingdom would have from having that much more gold would be if they wanted to buy something from other kingdoms and they wanted to use that gold to then give and trade. Okay, so don't misunderstand. I'm not saying the accumulation of gold is useless, but I'm saying the only reason you would want to do it, insofar as you're going to use the gold as money, the only reason that makes you better off to have more gold rather than less from the whole nation's viewpoint, the whole kingdom's viewpoint, is if you wanted to then import something down the road. Okay, so it's, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying it's irrational to want to accumulate money. Just like for an individual household, it's rational if somebody says, hey, let's save a lot for the next few years and build up a big checking account balance. That makes sense, but why? Because at some point you might want to spend that money, all right? So you don't want to accumulate money for its own sake. You can accumulate money so that if you ever have a situation where you want to acquire real goods and services, then you have this big, nice stockpile of money saved up, right? So it was those sorts of observations and insights that Adam Smith made in The Wealth of Nations, which is partly why it's such a famous book. Okay, so Smith went through and showed that, you know, he drew a lot of analogies between an individual household running its finances and an entire nation. And he was saying, you know, no individual household would ever adopt the policy that let's produce everything in-house, right? The people don't grow their own food and make their own clothes. because they're thinking, oh, well, I don't want to give my money away to others, that would be crazy to have that mentality. But yet that's what mercantilism does at the national level. Okay, so a lot of what I'm going to be doing in this lecture is just distilling some of the greatest hits, if you will, of economists' attempt to make the case for free trade and to show why the mercantilist ideas were wrong then and they're still wrong today. Okay, one thing that you need to understand to get into this material is what do we mean by a trade deficit or a surplus? Okay, so a trade deficit means that one country sells, or I should say, buys more stuff either from another country or from all the countries put together. You know, you can have a trade deficit with respect to just one other country, or you can have a trade deficit with the rest of the world. It depends what the category is you're talking about. But if you're going to talk about, for example, a trade deficit between two countries, what does it mean when we say that the United States is running a trade deficit with Japan? It means that people in the United States collectively are spending more money buying things produced in Japan than people in Japan collectively, how much money they're spending buying things produced in the United States. So that's what a trade deficit is. Okay. Let's just go through this a little bit here. There's a couple nuances. So one thing is we're using it in measured in money. Okay. So because in reality, there's no other metric you could use. There's no way to reduce it to a common denominator. Like, you could say we're going to do it in terms of weight and say, okay, everything that somebody in the United States imports from Japan, let's weigh the thing, put it on a scale and see how heavy it is, and we'll add up and get one big number and say people in the U.S. imported 2 billion tons worth of stuff from Japan last year, and then we could do the same thing with the Japanese. But that would be economically meaningless, right? Because if people in the U.S. imported computers that were really expensive, they wouldn't weigh very much, but there'd be a lot of economic market value there. Whereas if people in Japan imported, I don't know, you know, a bunch of agricultural products, it might be pretty heavy, even though it was fairly cheap. Okay, so the point when we say import more in this context, when we say that, you know, the U.S. is running a trade deficit with Japan because people in the U.S. imported more than they exported to Japan, the way we're measuring the more or the less, we're reducing it to single numbers, and those numbers are dollars, right? We're measuring them in terms of money. Okay, and you might wonder, well, but there's different currencies going on, right? And so if you use the exchange rate, right? So if you're in the United States and you're trying to buy something that's made in Japan, ultimately, at some point along that chain, someone's probably having to convert dollars into yen, okay? Because the Japanese producer is probably getting paid in yen. He's certainly paying his employees in yen. He's not paying his employees in U.S. dollars, all right? So if you want to buy, I don't know, a TV made in Japan, then, you know, probably what happens is Walmart does it, right? So Walmart buys thousands at a time, if not more, TVs produced and manufactured in Japan. And so, you know, Walmart tells its bank to give payment to the Japanese bank that has a client that's the TV manufacturer. And then the two banks, when they get together, you know, they at some point they have to say, well, you're paying in dollars, but these people want to get paid in yen. And so they go into the foreign exchange markets. And so the person with the dollars has to say, okay, I have dollars to sell and I want to buy yen with it. And then there's somebody on the other side of the transaction who wants to use yen to buy dollars and says, oh, okay, that's good because I have yen and I want to buy dollars. And so they make a trade. And then the price at which the dollars exchange against the yen is what's called the exchange rate. Okay, so this is getting a little bit off topic. I just wanted to fill in that little gap just so you guys know what's going on. And that, so that's what happens. So when you hear things like the dollar fell against the yen or the dollar appreciated against the euro, that's because there are markets, foreign exchange markets, where people trade currencies against each other. Okay, but so what I'm saying is when we are talking about a trade deficit, and here in this particular illustration, I've got people in the United States are buying $900 million worth of Toyotas, and they're selling $800 million worth of wheat to Japan. My point is you can make it all into a common denominator, because even though the manufacturers in Japan might be charging in terms of yen, well, to come up with this 900 million figure, we just say, okay, well, at the exchange rates at which the trades occurred, how many US dollars was the equivalent of what they were getting paid? Okay? So with these numbers, with this example, you would say on that basis, there would be a $100 million trade deficit with Japan. Okay, in the real world, they're bigger than that, but I'm just saying with these specific numbers, that's what it would occur. Another thing that you should know, just clarify, when we're talking about trade deficits, that refers to goods and services. It does not refer to assets. All right, so when we say, so the way to think about it is to say things that are produced in the various countries. So here, you know, wheat is produced, it's grown in the United States, and they harvest it and then ship it across the ocean in a cargo ship. And the same thing, the cars are physically built in Japan, they get loaded onto a ship and get shipped across the ocean, okay. But if people in Japan buy $100 million worth of treasury bonds issued by the United States government, or if they buy $10 million worth of stock issued by U.S. corporations, that doesn't go into these figures. Okay, so again, when we're talking about a trade deficit or a surplus, we're talking about how much money are they spending on goods and services that are produced in the other country. We're not talking about financial assets. And so the flip side of the deficit is a surplus. So in this example, the U.S. would have a $100 million trade deficit with Japan, whereas the Japanese would have a $100 million trade surplus with the United States. All right? And if you're curious, that stuff I was talking about, the assets, that's like the flip side of it. Okay, so we're getting a little bit more complex than you totally need to know, but I'm just mentioning that in case you're don't understand how is it possible that the way that the United States can run a trade deficit with the rest of the world is that the rest of the world is like buying more U.S. assets than vice versa. Okay, so at some level, everything balances out. But the point is, if you're just looking at trades dealing with produced goods and services, then there can be deficits and surpluses. Okay, so what I did in the book, and that'll do it in this lecture as well, is I want to give just the general case for free trade, and then we'll go through and start looking at the problems with tariffs in particular. Okay, so the point is, rather than just starting from jumping right into the objections to tariffs, which are hindrances on trade, I thought, first of all, why don't we just take a big picture view and just try to give the general case for free trade. So what do we mean by free trade? All that means is that you're not, that the government doesn't put arbitrary restrictions on exchanges that occur with people who happen to be from another country. Okay, so thus far in the course, we've painted a picture of the market, the pure market economy, and how that works and the principles underlying it, you know, how prices are formed, how entrepreneurship works, how competition sort of promotes the interests of the consumers and the workers so that the you know, the entrepreneurs, in a sense, don't really have all the power. We walked through those things. And then last week, we took a first look at the problems of interventionism, and we saw how price controls can actually hurt the very people that they allegedly are helping. Okay, so we saw how deviations away from the pure market economy can actually lead to counterproductive results. All right, so when it comes to free trade, I mean, just you point out that if you see how it is that there can be mutually beneficial trades between people domestically, right, if you understand how the free market works just within your own country, well, then you can see why prima facie there should be a presumption that you should be able to trade freely with people in other countries. Okay, so that it's just an extension of the logic of a free market applied to the world, right? That they're saying, you know, if you think that a free market is good and people should be allowed to trade with whoever they want within your city or within your state, if you live in the United States, then why wouldn't you be able to do it with somebody who lives in your continent or who lives on the same planet as you do, right? That there's the point is there's not something that changes all of a sudden just because the person you want to possibly do business with happens to live in another country. Okay, now, hang on, so let me just jump ahead a second. I just want to make sure okay. Okay, so now this slide on comparative advantage. This is the, when you want to make the case for free trade in the classroom, this is usually what they do, and they'll give numerical illustrations and showing how a nation can benefit trading with another nation, even if the first nation is superior in making all the different possible goods and services. Okay, so that strikes people as counterintuitive at first. So let me just make sure you follow the logic here. So it's not surprising to say that if one nation is good at making some items and another nation is good at making different items, that the people inside each country can be made richer if they trade with each other. Okay, so that's not too surprising. That just seems like it's saying, yeah, there's benefits from trade. Some people are good at one thing, some people are good at something else, and so you'd specialize. But what's really intriguing is that you can even make the case for free trade when one nation is better at making everything. And when I say better, what I mean is that its workers are more productive. And so it takes fewer resources for them to make a given amount of the product compared to the people in the other country. Okay, so you know, if the United States is really good at making cars, and it's also good at making computers, and it's also good at growing apples, whereas people in Mexico, they're not as good at any of those things. And again, what do I mean when I say not as good? Meaning that for them to make 1,000 cars would take them a lot more worker hours, and it would take them a lot more oil, and it would take them a lot more megawatts of electricity, and it would take them a lot more tons of steel. Okay, that's what I mean, that in terms of which economy can take a certain amount of resources and physically transform them into the most output goods, even if one country is superior in every product line, still, its people can be made richer by having the option of trading with other countries. Because what happens is, once you allow free trade to occur, that naturally market forces will lead the superior country to focus its resources producing those products and services where it has the comparative advantage, right? So it has the absolute advantage in everything possibly, but it still would only have the comparative advantage in some items. And then the countries that are inferior in an absolute sense in everything, they still, the market prices would lead them to concentrate their resources in producing the things where their inferiority is the smallest, meaning where they have the comparative advantage. Okay, so if you remember back, I forget which lesson it was, but the example when we talked about comparative advantage before, but the context was at an individual level. And we talked about, I think her name was Marsha, the store owner in the mall who owned the clothing retail outlet store. And remember that the two tasks that had to be done for her business was to be out on the floor and try to, you know, talk to the customers and try to sell clothes. And then the other task that had to be done was cleaning up the store so that it could be ready to open the next day. And when we said that, you know, Marsha was the owner and she was good at both tasks. And then she was considering hiring some teenage boy to help her. And at first glance, you would think that she would have nothing to gain from associating with this kid because she was better at both tasks. She could sell clothes. You know, she could close a sale. She could move more product, move more merchandise in a given time frame than this kid could. And she could clean up the store faster than the kid could. So on one hand, you would think that why, you know, she's just going to hurt her productivity if she associates with him and, you know, brings him into the business. That's going to lower the output of the business, right? You might think that. But in fact, it's, you know, we showed you with the numbers that's not what happened, right? That what happens is the way Marsha makes the most profit running her store is she hires the kid, and then she has him clean up the store because just the way the numbers worked out, her advantage in selling merchandise was bigger than her superiority in cleaning up the store. She was better at both, but she was really good compared to that kid in terms of selling products. So by hiring him, that freed up her time so she could focus on the things where she was really good. Or, you know, different example, a doctor. You know, a doctor, maybe a medical doctor, can take your blood pressure faster than the nurse can. But even so, the doctor, you know, to maximize his or her productivity, they hire a bunch of support staff so that when you go into the waiting room, the doctor's not the one taking your blood pressure and asking you your symptoms. It's somebody else doing that. And so the doctor can just boom, 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 and just go around and spend 10 minutes on each patient. And that way you can maximize how many patients they see. Okay, so you see the principle there at the individual level, it makes a lot of sense. Or a corporate lawyer isn't going to be typing up his memos and isn't going to do all the legal research before going into court. He's going to have paralegals and, you know, other interns and stuff helping him do all that stuff. Even if he's better at each of those tasks than the people he hired, he does it because it frees up his time to focus on those things where his superiority is really manifest. Okay? So it's the same thing if you broaden it and look at it at the scale of nations, that even if it's true that the United States can, you know, with a 1,000 hours worth of labor and some other resources measured in physical terms, even if it's true that they can produce more cars or more apples or more software than the same amount of labor hours and physical amounts of resources in Mexico, it doesn't follow that therefore it would be lowering the productivity of U.S. workers or it would be lowering their standard of living if they had transactions involving Mexican workers, right? That would be the same. To think that would be the same fallacy of saying that Marsha, the store owner, can't possibly benefit from hiring that kid to help her. So it's the same thing here, that by having, because here's what's going on. U.S. consumers don't want to just buy cars, or they don't want to just eat wheat, right? They want to have a whole mix of things. And so if the United States, and I'm sorry for foreign listeners, I'm talking about the U.S. just because that's the way I usually teach it, so that's coming to me naturally. But obviously, you would adapt it to your own country to understand why free trade is good for your country and the people in your country. But I'm, of course, you know, thinking it as an American, so that's why I'm using that as the example. So people in the United States, the consumers there, if they had to just consume things that were made domestically, well, then U.S. producers would have to produce all those different things, right? Because they'd have to make cars, they'd have to grow apples, they'd have to grow wheat, they'd have to make software, they'd have to do all these different things. And in the exact same proportions that the consumers wanted to consume them, right? And so the point is, if we now have the option of maybe outsourcing, if you will, some of that work to Mexico and having workers in Mexico do some of those tasks and then shipping us some of those products, whatever it is that we import from Mexico, well, then now U.S. workers don't have to make all that stuff because some of it's coming from Mexico, and that's satisfying the demands for those products that are coming from U.S. consumers. So now U.S. workers are freed up. They don't have to make every last little thing. They can now focus on just some of the things that American consumers want. And, of course, they're going to focus in the areas where they're really good, where their superiority is the highest. All right. And so the idea is if everyone around the world, if every country around the world is doing that, well, then there's more total stuff being made on planet Earth. And so there's more total stuff to go around, and then through trade, everybody can be made better off compared to the situation where each nation just produces for itself. Okay, so in one sense, you know, this is just elaborating or taking to the logical extreme the case for trade in the first place. Like, why is it that you trade with other people? And we talked about how that enhances productivity, so now people are making more stuff total, and so if they trade with each other and they specialize and then trade, everybody can have more of everything. And it's the same thing with free trade in the context of trade among nations, that if nations specialize in the things that their workers are the best at, then there's more total stuff made on Earth, and then they trade the surpluses, and everyone can have a higher standard of living. All right. So it's funny that one of the problems with this whole topic of international trade is that it makes you think in collectivist terms, right? And it's even, you know, it makes you say things like Japan's trading with the United States, when really that's not what's going on. You know, if let me just flip back to this slide for a minute, this slide right here. And in one respect, I mean, this is very misleading and it's a bad way of thinking, but it's sort of unavoidable because I want to make sure you guys understand the flaws with mercantilist thinking. And since the mercantilists think this way, you sort of have to get into their mindset to show the problems with it. So in one respect, talking like this and saying, you know, how much did Americans buy from Japan and vice versa, that's sort of an arbitrary thing. I mean, it would be like saying, well, how much Coca-Cola did redheads buy yesterday? Or, you know, how many hours did people with blue eyes work last week? And that's not normally a way that you classify that information. You normally don't care how much stuff people with red hair bought, right? You might look at other things. You know, you might say how much Pepsi did vegetarians buy or something, you know, if you're doing marketing research. But you usually wouldn't care about, let's go count up how much money people with red hair spent. And so in that respect here, we're sort of arbitrarily just saying, how much stuff did consumers who happen to live in the United States buy from Japan last year? And then let's compare that number with how much stuff people who happen to live in Japan spent on stuff that was produced in the United States last year. And let's see which number is bigger. You know, in one respect, economically, that's a meaningless figure. Like, who cares? That would be like saying, did people with red hair buy more stuff than people with blue eyes? Like, who cares? That doesn't mean anything economically. That doesn't affect me. You know, in your day-to-day life, that would have no impact at all. But the reason it does in the real world is that that's how politicians and pressure groups classify things, and it can affect legislation. So it actually does affect you, not because intrinsically it matters, but because other people think it matters, and then that affects the policies that are put in place that then really do affect you. Okay, so moving along now, this slide on the household analogy, what I'm getting at in this particular slide is that there's a discussion in the textbook saying to understand the case for free trade and to understand the problems with protectionism, and protectionism is just a word meaning government policies that interfere with trade, that they erect trade barriers. And so the reason you call it protectionism is because the supporters of those policies say we're protecting domestic industries, right? They say that we're creating jobs at home by putting up barriers to foreign goods trying to come into our country. And so protectionism is the philosophy or the mentality of putting up trade barriers to try to promote at-home industries or jobs, okay? Because that's, in our day and age, that's now the justification. I should probably make sure you guys get that. I'm sure most of you have already seen this, and you know it firsthand, but so back before the classical economists came on the scene, the mercantilists there, I mean, their doctrines were, they had the goal of accumulating money. I mean, they probably also talked about promoting industry and stuff like that, but I mean, they were thinking in terms of, let's accumulate stockpiles of gold and silver coin, or bars, right? Whereas now, because countries are all using fiat money, I mean, it's not that really that a politician's going to get up there and say, we're going to put up a trade barrier with Japan because we don't want to run out of dollar bills, right? That would sound kind of funny, since we just make dollar bills out of paper. You know, it's not hard for the it's actually the Treasury, to physically crank out some more $100 bills, right? So the reason now that politicians will say the United States needs to have trade barriers, it's not because we don't want to run out of dollar bills and have all these foreigners take our money. It's rather that the justification is we want to create U.S. jobs. We want to keep jobs here at home. And so the idea is, the popular idea, and this, again, it's a very powerful idea, and it's really hard to get the average person, at least in the United States, I mean, I'm assuming it's like this in other countries too, but certainly in the United States, Americans are very distrustful of foreigners, and one of the ways that distrust or suspicion manifests itself is if there are goods coming in that were made by foreigners, a lot of Americans just instinctively think that's putting Americans out of business, that there are U.S. workers who could have been making that thing, and so you're being unpatriotic if you buy goods produced by foreigners. Okay, so there's a movement called Buy American, B-U-Y, so purchase things made in America, or people will proudly drive trucks made by Ford or other U.S. automakers in Detroit, and they'll have bumper stickers that say, you know, I drive American, meaning, you know, I don't drive no car made by those Japanese. I buy a car made by U.S. workers in the good U.S. of A, and that they think they're being very patriotic because if I only drive a Ford, well, then that keeps the business here in the United States, and that employs workers in Detroit, rather than sending my business over helping workers in Japan. Okay, so that's the mentality. And I'm assuming that's a fairly common thing. It's not just in the United States, but I just want to make sure I didn't assume that I spelled that out. Okay, so that's what we're critiquing in this lecture and in this section of the book. Okay, we're trying to show why that mentality, to think that if you spend your money on stuff made by people in your country, that that's helping your country become wealthier compared to if you, you know, bought stuff made by a foreigner, that somehow would you'd be making your country poorer if you did that. All right, we're trying to attack that idea. Okay, so one of the analogies I used is I said that look, if the logic of protectionism is correct, if it really makes sense that if the U.S. government puts a barrier to trade around the country, so to keep out foreign competition, to keep out goods made by foreigners, if that would really make Americans richer because it promotes job opportunities and causes job creation, well, then why stop there? You know, wouldn't it also be true? Suppose there were some eccentric father and he calls in his family, you know, his wife, and let's say he's got three or four kids. And he says, okay, guys, you know what? In order to make our family richer, I lost the video, but I think we're back. He said, okay, guys, in order to make the household wealthier from now on, I forbid everyone in this household to ever spend any money on anything made by anyone outside of this household. So if you want food, you can't go to the store and buy it. You can't go to a restaurant and buy it. You have to either grow it in the backyard yourself, or you can ask your brother or your sister to do it, or your mother or me, and then you can pay us for the food. But under no circumstances are you allowed to pay any money to people outside of this household to acquire food. And if you want clothes, same deal. You can make your own clothes, or you can pay one of your siblings to do it for you, or you can pay one of us to do it. But you're not allowed to go to the mall and buy a shirt, because that would be, that would be taking away an opportunity for someone in our household to do that job. Okay, and the same thing, you know, if you're sick and you need somebody to do a medical operation, don't you dare go to the hospital. Have one of us do it. Okay, and so think of how much wealthier we're going to be now. We're going to be so busy. We're going to have all kinds of job opportunities, because all this other stuff that normally you guys would be foolishly giving that business to other people that aren't even a member of our family, now we're going to keep it all in the family. And so just think of how much richer we're going to be. Okay, so when you see it at that level, it's obviously insane. And you can quite easily see the fallacies involved, that, you know, it would just be the money in the household just circulating, and that money wouldn't really be worth anything, or wouldn't be worth much if you were only allowed to spend it on people in your household, right? Like, what would be the point of having $100,000 in cash if you weren't allowed to spend it except with your brother and sister and your parents, right? It wouldn't be as valuable to you. Okay, so you can see how there that encapsulates the logic, and that's the sort of thing that Adam Smith was talking about, that if you have a whole kingdom, what good is it to accumulate all sorts of gold and silver if it has to stay within the country's borders, right? That doesn't make your people wealthier. What makes them wealthier is if they have the option of then using it to buy stuff from foreigners. Okay, so it's the same thing at the household level. And all the reasons, too, that, you know, if you think through, why is it that that would be insane if a household did that? Well, because you, rather than making all your own food and clothing and changing your own oil and building your own garage and all those other things that you'd have to do by your own or with the help of your brothers and sisters, it's a lot more productive if you hire others to do that who are really good at that stuff, and then you in turn specialize in the things where you excel. And so you earn money, you earn income producing, you know, focusing on the thing where you're really good, and then you use that money to then buy the services and goods from everybody else. And that's what everyone in the community is doing, right? So that's clearly a much more sensible policy than just saying, no, we don't want to give away business opportunity to people outside the family. So it's the same thing at the national level, that the U.S. president, if he is like the father to the whole country and says, you're not allowed to do business with anyone outside these walls. If you have something you need to have done, have one of your fellow citizens do it. that that policy would be insane for the same reasons. Now, it wouldn't be as insane because the United States is a very big country and there's lots of people and there's lots of natural resources. So if the U.S. federal government literally put up a wall around the whole country and said you can't trade with foreigners, it would make the United States much poorer. But I mean, it wouldn't be as catastrophic as a father saying to his family, we're not allowed to trade with people outside this household. Okay, but again, it's not a qualitative difference. It's just a matter of degree. All right, those policies are crazy for the same reasons. It's just more exaggerated in the case of the household. And then, of course, too, if you can see why an absolute ban on foreign imports would be bad, well, then again, it's just to see why a barrier that's not an absolute ban is bad. It's the same principle. Okay, so if it's not good to completely bar foreign imports, why would it be good to put a 10% tax on them? Right, putting a 10% tax is better than completely banning them. But if you understand why the ban would be counterproductive, then you can see why the 10% tax also isn't a good idea. Okay, so let's talk about tariffs in particular now. So what is a tariff? It is a tax that the government puts on foreign goods coming into the country. All right, so that if people want to buy something, it has an extra tax on it if it happens to come from a foreign country. So when we're trying to understand why is a tariff distortionary and why does it upset the outcome that would be in a market economy and why and what are the ways in which it harms consumers, well, the first thing I like to point out is that, look, a tariff is a tax. Okay, so somebody who is telling you that the way to promote your country's prosperity is by putting up a protective tariff, then that's what they're saying is the way to encourage prosperity is to raise taxes on our own people. And that's an important point. A lot of people have this idea that the tariff is just paid for by the foreigners, that it's a tax on foreigners and it's the foreign companies paying it. But that's a bit misleading. That no, the tariff is actually levied on the U.S. Well, if it's a U.S. tariff, whatever your country is, the tariff levied by your government falls upon the citizens who want to buy something, right? So if it's in the U.S. context, if there's a tariff put on Japanese cars, well, what that means then is the U.S. consumer who's thinking about buying a car is going to see like a Ford that's at a certain price and then see a Toyota that's at a certain price, but the certain price of the Toyota is actually artificially higher because the U.S. government is putting a tax on the foreign-made car. Okay, so it's the people who are advocating protectionist barriers, and a lot of times too, it's right-wing people that do it, like Pat Buchanan and people like that argue that for various reasons, the U.S. would prosper if we put in place tariff barriers. And, you know, it's if I ever got the chance to debate one of those people, I think that'd be the first point I would make, is just to say, okay, so what you're saying is the way to increase American prosperity is to raise taxes on U.S. citizens, because that's what a tariff is. And, they obviously don't normally frame it like that. Okay, another important point here is that what a tariff does, it doesn't actually create jobs on net or in total. All it does is rearrange employment. Right? And there's different ways of seeing that. So one way is to first of all realize that in a market economy, once wages and other prices adjust, eventually everyone who wants to work is going to get a job. Okay, so, you know, the only things that would really prevent long-term, the only thing that would prevent workers from getting jobs in the long term is direct government interventions with wages, right? So we saw how the minimum wage last week, we saw if the government sets the minimum wage above the market clearing level, then there's people who can't find work indefinitely, okay? But here, a tariff isn't directly affecting wages, okay? So my point is, with or without a tariff, ultimately everybody in the country who wants to get a job is going to get a job. And so the tariff does not create jobs on net. What happens is if the tariff gets put in place, it can cause jobs to be added to certain sectors of the economy, namely the ones that are being protected by the tariff. But at the same time, it causes other jobs to be destroyed. Okay, so again, originally, let me put it this way. There's only so many workers to go around. They have to do various things. And so it's true, if the government comes along and puts in place a tariff, and again, I'm just going to use the U.S. example because that's the easiest for me. If the U.S. government comes along and puts in place a high tariff on foreign automobiles, it's true, that will allow domestic producers to charge higher prices, and so they'll move along their supply curve, and they'll have to make more cars because now American consumers are seeing the price of foreign cars artificially go up, and so they're going to now buy more U.S. cars. So it's true that U.S. automakers will see their business go up because of the tariff. And so they'll have to hire more workers. So it's definitely true that if the U.S. government puts in place a high tariff on foreign cars, that will expand the amount of jobs in the U.S. automobile sector. That's true. But the point is, where are those workers coming from? It's not like they were previously all just unemployed, right? They were coming from other sectors. And so those jobs elsewhere shrink, right? So all you're doing by putting in place a tariff is you're just rearranging where the labor goes. And since you're distorting the incentives and the prices that are communicating the comparative advantage that people have, you're actually channeling workers into areas where they're really not that productive. Okay? So that's what's happening. So that, again, the tariff doesn't create new jobs on net. All it does is it shunts workers into areas where they actually don't have their comparative advantage. And so that's actually unproductive in the grand scheme of things. Okay, another important point here is to realize that at a certain level of generality, okay, and I say that because you can get real nitpicky and talk about stuff about nations who want to invest more in financial assets and things. So I deal with those objections in the footnotes of the textbook if you want to follow that stuff up. But at a certain broad level, this introductory level, it's fine to think of it this way, that look, a nation ultimately pays for its imports with exports. And so continue with this example, if the United States government puts in place a high tariff keeping out Japanese cars or discouraging them, then what happens is, think of it this way, that means in a sense Japanese producers now are getting fewer dollars, right? Because now U.S. consumers aren't buying as many Japanese automobiles. And so now that makes it them less able to buy wheat from the United States. Okay, because, now it's true, it gets a little complicated with fiat money, where dollars are trading against yen, and it involves exchange rates and things like that. So it does get complicated. I mean, it's still true, but it gets more complicated. But if you think of it in terms of gold, imagine we were that every country used gold, then the point would be pretty obvious, right? That if the U.S. is if people in the United States are buying stuff from Japan and with gold coins, and so they're spending a bunch on their cars, and then the Japanese are buying wheat from the United States with gold coins, you can see how if the people in the United States all of a sudden stopped spending so much because of a tariff, right? If the U.S. government puts a 20% tax on Japanese cars, so now U.S. consumers are less likely to buy Japanese cars. So now there's less gold flowing over the across the ocean into the hands of the Japanese because we're buying fewer of their cars. Well, now they have less gold with which to buy U.S. wheat. And so their demand for U.S. wheat falls. Okay, so that's part of what's going on here. So you see, it's not true that a high tariff helps U.S. producers in general. Well, no, it helps the particular U.S. producers who are competing with the product that's now has the tariff put on it, but it hurts the producers who were previously exporting to the country that now just had its products hit with a tariff. Okay, so again, ultimately a nation pays for its imports with exports, and so measures that reduce how much a nation can import actually boomerang and mean that the other nations now can't afford to buy as much of our exports. And so you're not, in the long run, going to benefit your producers on net, because you're helping your people who compete with imports, but you're hurting the producers that export. Okay, another argument, and this one was made by Henry George. It's a really clever argument. He says, look, I'm paraphrasing, but he says, isn't it odd, why is it that during peacetime that the government tells us that the way we're going to promote prosperity is we're going to put a mild barrier around our country to discourage foreign goods from coming in, and we're saying that that's going to create jobs and promote prosperity at home? And he said, but if we're at war with some other country, what do we do to them if we have a stronger navy? We put our ships around that other country, and we do our best to prevent foreign goods from getting into that country. We put up a blockade. And so his point is, if the logic of protectionism were correct, then in wartime, we would be making our opponents wealthy by doing that. If by barring foreign goods from entering other countries, wouldn't we be giving them job opportunities? Wouldn't we be creating a lot of jobs for their domestic workforce? Wouldn't we be enforcing their own tariff laws for them by doing that? And obviously the answer is no, that you can see when it comes to war, you hurt another country by making them rely only on their own resources, by cutting them off from the rest of the world, by taking away their option of trading with others. It's obvious that that hurts people. And so Henry George's point was, well, then in a sense, during peacetime, we put a mini blockade on ourselves with tariffs. And so if you can understand why in wartime you hurt another country by putting a blockade around it, well, then you should also understand why in peacetime your government is hurting your own country if it puts a mini blockade in place. Okay, and then the last slide, and I'll turn to your guys' questions, is quotas. So I just ran through, and I should just stress, in this lecture, I was hitting the key points, right? You really do need to read the textbook. So if you're just if you're not taking this class for credit and you listen to some lectures and but don't read everything in the textbook, this is a chapter where I would encourage you to go ahead and just read it, because there I make the case a lot more rigorously than I did here. Here I just have time to hit some of the main points. So we just talked about tariffs and the problems of tariffs and how they make a country poorer. And then there's also this issue of quotas. So I just want to make sure you guys understand the distinction between the two. So a tariff is where the government tinkers with the price of the imports. So the government says, we're going to put a tax on these goods coming in the country. And they could either be a percentage or it could be a flat amount of money. So, you know, if the United States, the government might say, oh, any Japanese car coming in to be sold in the United States, we're going to put a 10% tax on it. Or they might say, we're going to put a $1,000 tariff on it. Okay, so just whatever the price is going to be on top of that now, you have to pay $1,000 to the U.S. government if you want to buy it and you're an American citizen. Or if it's a percentage, then whatever the price is pre-tax, now you multiply that number by 10%, and then that's the money that gets sent directly to the U.S. government if you're an American citizen who wants to buy that car. Okay, so that's what a tariff is. A quota, in that setup, the government sets up restrictions on the quantity. Right? So it's not directly affecting the price. It's directly affecting the quantity. Excuse me. So the U.S. government might say, last year 5 million vehicles came in, and so this year we're going to put a quota in place, and now only 3 million foreign vehicles can come in. And that would be the thing. So after the 3 millionth vehicle comes in, the U.S. government says, okay, that's it, no more. And so that the effects of quotas are similar, because they're now that you're restricting the quantity, the new market price ends up rising. All right, so U.S. consumers are still paying higher prices for automobiles. It's just the way that the price goes up is because the quantity has been artificially restricted, as opposed to slapping on a percentage or a flat fee amount on top of the original price. All right, and I argued in the book too that quotas in some respects are more dangerous than tariffs, because with a tariff you know how much damage is being done, right? If the government levies a 10% tariff, well then you know, okay, this thing is 10% more than it otherwise would have been, and so you can get a handle on that. And if you want to, and if people want to import more, they can. Whereas with a quota, if it's hard to know exactly how much, it's hard to know how much the outcome is deviating from what would happen in a free market, put it that way. Okay, because with a quota, if the government comes along and puts in a limit on how many vehicles can come in, in order to know how severe that is, you would have to know how many vehicles would have come in without the quota. See, whereas with the tariff, if the government says 10% tax, even if 10 years go by and you want to say, I wonder how much impact that tariff is having now, you know pretty easily. You could say, well, this thing is 10% more expensive than it otherwise would be. Whereas with the quota, you don't know that, because if they put the quota in place and then 10 years go by and you say, how distortionary do you think this is? It's a lot harder to say, because you don't know in the intervening 10 years what the amount of imports would have been if there hadn't been that quota in place. So it's harder to know. Okay, let me just give a big picture summary, because I never actually made this point in this lecture, and I think I should. And then I'll turn over your questions. So what happens with restrictions on trade, generally speaking, is that the restrictions benefit certain people in the population and they harm others, but that on net, they cause more harm than good. Okay, so again, just keep working with the same example. It is true. So don't misunderstand me. It is true that if the U.S. government puts in place a tariff on Japanese automobiles, that will help U.S. automakers. Okay, so the shareholders of Ford and all those other companies, they will be richer because of the tariff. So the people who work at those automobile plants in Detroit and in other factories, they also will be better off. Okay, they can either get paid more, or maybe they're gonna get a job working in those factories when otherwise they wouldn't have been able to. Okay, so those people might have a higher standard of living because of the tariff. But there are other people who are made worse off. So obviously, U.S. consumers who wanted to buy a car are worse off because now their options have been reduced. Before, they could have bought an American car and a Japanese car, and now the Japanese car is artificially more expensive. And even people who didn't want to buy a Japanese car, who just wanted to buy an American-made car, they're worse off also because the prices of the American cars are going to go up because of the tariff. All right, because the tariff, again, makes the Japanese cars more expensive. So then U.S. consumers shift their demand, you know, they increase their demand for American-made cars because they're substitutes, right? American-made cars are substitutes for Japanese cars. And so then with the higher demand, the new equilibrium price of U.S.-made cars is higher than it was before. Okay, so that's why U.S. automakers like a tariff on foreign vehicles, is because it allows them to charge a higher price because they get a higher demand for their product. Okay, so again, even somebody who never planned on buying a Japanese car can be hurt by a tariff on Japanese cars, because now when he goes to buy a Ford, it's more expensive than it otherwise would be. He has to pay more to Ford to get the same car than he would have had to in the absence of the tariff. Okay, so that consumer's worse off. And then another group who's hurt by the tariff are U.S. exporters, right? So the wheat farmer who normally would have sent a bunch of wheat over to Japan, well, the price that he can get now goes down because the demand for U.S. wheat drops, since now Japanese producers are getting, loosely speaking, fewer dollars. Okay, and so by restricting the amount of imports in the U.S., it hurts U.S. exporters. Okay, so I'm just walking you through here. You can see there are winners and losers. There are people who gain and people who lose from the implementation of a tariff, but it's not a zero-sum game. The losses to the losers are bigger than the gains to the winners. And we know that that's going to be true in general, because again, the tariff is not making us wealthier. All the tariff is a tax. It just distorts things. It just shifts resources from where they're in their comparative advantage into areas where they're not as productive. Okay, it makes them artificially seem productive because it keeps out the competition. So, you know, that you can kind of see, in a sense, it can't be making everybody better off. And so collectively, we're going to be poorer because of the tariff. And then because certain groups benefit from it, we sort of can reason, okay, well, if we're all collectively poorer on average, but some of us are actually better off, it must be that the rest of us, you know, are so much worse off that our losses are bigger than the gains to the winners, making us on average worse off. Okay, so that's generally what happens with the tariff. And that's also why politically it's so hard to get rid of tariffs, because the benefits are concentrated among a few groups and the harms are dispersed among everybody. All right, so I mean, there have been estimates. I can't give you an exact number. I haven't looked at them recently, but there are estimates, like when there was the George Bush administration, W. Bush administration, put in place import restrictions. I don't remember if they were, I don't even think they were tariffs. I think they were just like quotas or something, but I can't remember, on steel. And they did some estimates as to how much the country, in a sense, paid for every job that was created. So they looked at how many more jobs in steel were likely created by this, and they looked at the costs, in a sense, imposed on everybody else in the form of higher prices and everything. And it was something absurd. It was like over $200,000 per job. I think it was even over like $700,000, but I don't remember the exact number. And obviously those steel workers were not earning $700,000 in their paycheck. So that's, you know, you can see studies like that to show just how wasteful it is, that in order to expand employment in the so-called protected industries, consumers collectively are paying higher prices. And so in a sense, it's one way of putting it is it would be cheaper, rather than having a tariff to expand jobs in Detroit auto factories, it would be cheaper if the government just raised taxes on everybody and then just sent checks to those workers and let them stay home and watch TV. That you could pay them, you know, more money than they would earn working at the factory, and consumers would have more money left over rather than imposing a tariff. Okay, so that just shows you how inefficient these things can be. Okay, well, why don't I stop there and I'll turn it over to your questions. Excuse me. We've got about 15 minutes, so I'll pull up the Academy website to see if anyone's posted one there, but in the meantime, if you guys have questions, you can also just post them in the chat box, because there's only about 10 of you logged in right now, so it should be manageable. Okay, we do have a question from someone live, so I'll field that one first, and then if the other people who are tuned in live don't have more questions, I'll go to the ones that are in the queue. Okay, so Brad says, please comment on Peter Schiff's view that we have moved all of our manufacturing to China, and as consumers, we're buying products with debt, and the trade deficit is built on consumption. In your book, you say that a trade deficit in and of itself isn't the problem. So is it a problem if it is driven by consumption, and why? Okay, that's a great question. So let me answer it in a sort of long-winded way, just to for pedagogical reasons, to make some important points about how people should think about these issues. So it's true. In the book, I say a trade deficit by itself is not cause for alarm. Because again, what is a trade deficit? In a sense, it's a statistical artifact. It's like an almost meaningless bit of information. Just like saying, how much did redheads spend on Pepsi? Who cares? How much did Americans spend on goods from China? And then let's compare that number to how much the Chinese spent on goods from America. Who cares? In the same way that nobody gets upset about, you know, oh, what if Florida ran a trade deficit with New Jersey? Wouldn't that be bad? You know, what if it turned out that people in Florida last year spent more money buying stuff that happened to be produced in New Jersey and then was, you know, shipped by truck to Florida, or if they bought online services and, you know, things, compared to how much money people in New Jersey spent buying stuff from Florida? And that wouldn't the Floridians be in danger of running out of money? You know, wouldn't all their dollars be flowing to New Jersey until the point when people in Florida, you know, they were all out of work and they had no money left, and all the jobs and all the money were in New Jersey? And yeah, that's just goofy. Because, and just, it's important to think through, why is that silly? Because what's all that really matters is that your own household is financially okay. All right. And so an individual household can make decisions. You know, they can, if they want to buy something from New Jersey, that the fact that it's from New Jersey as opposed to Vermont, that's completely irrelevant. Who cares? Right. So in other words, you wouldn't want to, let's continue that. Let's say that Florida is running a trade deficit with New Jersey, but Florida is running a trade surplus with Vermont. Okay. And so you're thinking about buying something and you're looking online and you're, you know, you want to buy something on eBay, and you see two sellers who have the item that you want, and one of them lives in Vermont and one of them lives in New Jersey. You as a household, should you need to go check and see what your state's trade deficit is with those two states? No, that would be crazy. Why would you do that? You would just buy it from the person that was giving you the best price, or that, you know, had the best reputation, or you know, the best shipping options or whatever. Okay, but you wouldn't say, oh, well, I'm gonna pay a dollar more to buy it from the person who's selling it in Vermont, because right now we have a trade surplus with Vermont, and so therefore, you know, I'm not gonna be in danger of losing jobs here, of causing people in Florida to go out of work, but I don't want to do that. You know, I don't want to send more, even more of our money to New Jersey. Okay, because you could see how that'd be crazy. Why would you even think like that? All right, so it's in one sense, or so that's why economists in general will say trade deficit doesn't matter. Who cares? Excuse me. And it's true that some of Peter Schiff's stuff, he does, or he did. I haven't read his stuff recently. But when I first encountered Peter Schiff, I thought he was wrong, okay? And I have since seen the light, and I realized that he was correct, obviously, in the stuff he was saying. But my point is just, in some of his standalone essays, like his online articles and things that were only 800 words, and people would send them to me before I knew much about this guy, Peter Schiff, I would read it, and it looked like he was just saying the United States is importing more from the rest of the world than we're exporting. The world's going to end. And that by itself is not a good argument, all right? Or it's not a complete argument, because for the reasons I just said, that in general you can be importing more stuff than you export to any particular region, and who cares? Okay, so now, and that's the kind of stuff that, I mean, I want people in this class to understand, okay? But now let me up the ante a little bit. And so here, as is always happens with these questions and answers, this is beyond the scope that you guys need to know for this course, but what can happen, even at the household level, you can, if you think about it, if you're an individual household, it's not true that you can only spend what you first make, okay? So you might say, in a sense, you might think that, oh, well, in any given year, you can only consume how much your income is. But no, that's not true, because you can borrow, right? So if you make $50,000 from your job, you can still go out and buy more than $50,000 worth of stuff. And how do you do that? How do you finance that? Well, you can take out a loan from the bank. And so there, you would be living above your means, or living beyond your means, which that's just a colloquial way of saying you're spending more than your income, because you're incurring more debt. You're going into deeper and deeper debt to do it. All right. So that, even there, is it wrong to incur debt? Right? Can we conclude that if a given country is importing goods and services from the rest of the world, and the way that the country pays for it is by having foreigners accumulate bonds or IOUs, meaning that your country gets deeper and deeper into debt, is that by itself a bad thing? Well, not necessarily, right? I mean, if a couple buys a house and takes out a mortgage, how was the couple able to buy a $300,000 house when their joint incomes are only $100,000? Well, because they borrowed money from the bank. All right, so is that necessarily a bad thing? Maybe not. I mean, people, their opinions can differ, and some people really are just anti-debt. But my point is, at the individual household level, most people can understand that there are occasions where going into debt isn't a big deal, especially like if you're going to go to medical school or something to become a surgeon. A lot of people think it's perfectly reasonable to incur debt, you know, to take out student loans while you're going to school. And then when you become a surgeon, you're making a high income, then you pay them off. Okay, so the period where you're going deeper and deeper into debt, technically you are consuming more than you're producing. So you're running a trade deficit with the rest of humanity at that point when you're a student in medical school. Okay, so that's, so again, I mean, I'm just showing you in general, it's not true that a country that's running a trade deficit, even with the rest of the world, which the U.S. was and is, by the way, so it's not just that the U.S. has trade deficits with certain countries, it's that, because the U.S. has trade deficits with some countries and it has trade surpluses with other countries, but if you add them all up, the deficits are bigger than the surpluses. So on net, the U.S., you know, American citizens buy more stuff from foreigners than vice versa. And again, and the way that's financially possible is because U.S. indebtedness goes up. So that's, again, there's no, and there's one other possibility too, is you could sell off assets. Okay, so you wouldn't have to be that your debt goes up necessarily, but like foreigners could take over ownership of land in the U.S. or they could take over shares of stock of U.S. corporations. So that would be another way. Just like the individual household, if your income's $50,000 this year and you consume $60,000, that $10,000 gap, you don't need to go to a bank and get it. Maybe you have some jewelry that you can sell, or maybe you have a piece of land somewhere that you sell for $10,000, and that's the way you can do it too. Okay, so it's the same, you know, anything you can think of in terms of an individual household, you can sort of apply it at the national level and see some analog of that. Okay, so again, is it a problem? Well, in and of itself, no, because again, these trade accounts, these national accounts are just the aggregation of all the individual decisions. Okay? But that's not... But that's not to say that any, if collectively you don't like the outcome, that, you know, who are you going to point the finger at? Say you did the wrong thing. You know, if every individual person's doing what is correct in his or her own mind. So finally, back to your question, Brad. What was the problem of what's going on is, and I think Peter Schiff obviously was correct to look at these things, is I think you need to take into account the fact that the Federal Reserve was distorting everything. And again, everybody, this is beyond the scope of what we need for this class. Because the short answer is, because the Fed was producing a lot of liquidity during the housing boom years, and there was a housing bubble, what was happening is Americans thought they were richer than they really were, because their houses were rising at double-digit rates, their stock portfolio was going up, so Americans weren't saving as much, and also the dollar was artificially strong compared to other currencies because it was the global reserve currency. All right, so in other words, loosely speaking, Alan Greenspan was creating a bunch of dollars and handing them out, and so Americans had a lot of dollar bills, and the dollar wasn't falling against the euro and the yen and other currencies as much as it should have. And so Americans were able to buy a lot of stuff from foreigners by giving them our dollars. And so we imported all this thing. So the assets we were giving away were, in a sense, these dollars that Alan Greenspan was creating. Okay, but once prices corrected, once the housing bubble burst and the stock market crashed, and Americans realized, whoa, that they actually weren't that wealthy, then they really regretted all the purchases they made. Okay, so again, that's a very long way of getting to the answer to your question. in general, no, it's not problematic if a country does that. In this particular case, yes, it was. And I would say what happened is that American households were, they got swept up in the bubble mania and they thought they were wealthier than they really were. And so they were importing a lot more than they would have had they realized that their housing prices weren't going to keep going up. Okay, and Betty asks, will you be answering the questions for the professor in writing after our time limit is up to date? Yes, I will. Let me see if I can answer yours right now, though, Betty, before we leave. So Betty says, if removal of trade barriers makes everyone wealthier, how can we answer the criticism that people's jobs might move out of the country? Or perhaps I should ask, what should American workers, for example, be doing instead? What does the U.S. have in comparative advantage? Okay, that's a good question. So let me clarify. When I say removing trade barriers makes everyone wealthier, again, it means everyone on net, or it means everyone on average. All right, there are individuals who could be hurt. And so if we have a tariff in place protecting U.S. automakers from Japanese competition, and we remove that tariff barrier, it is true that all Americans collectively are now richer, and all Japanese are collectively are richer. But it's not necessarily true that each individual American is better off. In particular, the shareholders of Ford, the workers at the GM plants and so forth, they probably are going to be worse off because of removing that trade barrier. Okay, so make sure you understand that distinction, that when we're talking about these things, we're not saying every single person. But again, the reason you looking at that angle, you say, well, gee, well, then why should we do it? But you can also look at it from the other angle and say, if we were originally in a state of free trade and now the government comes along and imposes that burden, it's helping a few people at the expense of everybody else. And on top of that, the damage to everyone else is bigger than the amount that it's helping the people that it benefits. Now, as far as... Okay, you're asking, like, what should the U.S. workers be doing instead? Well, there's plenty of things that they do. I mean, there's plenty of things where the U.S. exports stuff. I mean, off the top of my head, I can't tell you that many. I mean, I know it's agriculture. The U.S. is a huge exporter of agricultural products and software and financial services, things like that. But it's the issue with, again, it's not a question of are they going to be able to find work at all, because wages would adjust. All right, so not that this would happen, but let me just show you what I mean. People are saying, oh, well, there would be all those mass exodus of jobs if we got rid of all trade barriers. You know, all the jobs right now that U.S. people do that could be done in India would get outsourced to India. Okay, well, no, I mean, in the limit, what would happen? And then if the people in the U.S. had nothing to do, well, their wages could fall to the level of the workers in India. And then there would be no reason to outsource it. Okay, so don't misunderstand me. I'm not predicting that would happen, but I'm saying ultimately that would be the last thing that could possibly happen. Right? So it's not a question of can people find work in a market economy. Wages could adjust so anyone who wants to work can get a job. So the issue is not, oh, if we got rid of these trade barriers, would there be 20% unemployment forever? Well, no. If those people wanted a job, wages would fall until the point at which it made more sense to hire them than to outsource it to India. Okay, now you say, would the U.S. worker, you know, do something for $3 an hour because that's what the person in India is getting paid? Well, no, he wouldn't. He would do something else. You know, what would it be? I don't know. But there's all sorts of jobs that people do in the United States that pay more than what people make in India. Okay, so that's it. So it's true. There could be something, you know, with a trade barrier in place. Somebody in the United States might be making $30 an hour doing something. And then if the government gets rid of that, and then the job goes over to India for $3 an hour, and now this U.S. worker's up, and maybe they have to go get a job that only pays $15 an hour. Okay, so that person, don't get me wrong, that person is hurt. There's no doubt about it. But the point is there are plenty of other jobs that pay more than what these outsourced people get paid in their countries, and that's actually a reflection of U.S. productivity. Okay, that the reason American workers get paid more is because they're more productive. That's how it's possible. So we American workers produce more stuff per hour than the typical Indian or Mexican worker, and that's why U.S. wages are higher. Okay, so it's not that U.S. wages are higher because the government keeps out those goods. No, it's that U.S. wages are higher because we're more productive. And, you know, without having tariff barriers, like labor just goes to where it is going to be the most productive. All right, so I don't know if I've totally answered your question, but that's the short answer I'd given. If you want me to say more, just go ahead and, you know, follow up in the Q&A section here. Okay, well, we're out of time because Tom Woods has his class coming on, so we got to sign off now. Okay, so thanks, everybody, and I will see you next week. Remember to do your quizzes.